For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning. I'm Douglas Floyd. I'm speaking because our teacher, Taigen Dan Layton, is on sabbatical, coming back in October. And members of the Sangha are taking up the slack while he is gone. I'm really grateful that so many of you are here. For the people who are listening this through our website or our podcast, it's April 14th. The temperature is about 33 degrees, and it's snowing pretty hard outside. Just the temperature and the precipitation make it very damp and chilling. The cold goes right to the bone. You know, 6 weeks ago, we wouldn't have cared about it. We'd have just put on the coat and maybe some boots and headed out. But it's April, and it's not supposed to be this way, which is an important lesson in Buddhism lesson, right? That we've created this idea that this time has... This is the way it's supposed to be. This is the identity of April, and it's not matching. And so we not just cold, but glum about it, I think. So maybe instead of a Dharma talk, it would be much more effective for us to just put on our clothes and walk around the block and deal with our feelings about this. But that's not what I had prepared for today. I have had us all get copies of a koan from the Book of Serenity, which is one of the three most widely read collections of koan teaching stories from classical Chinese Chinese Zen Buddhism. And it was created in two stages. One was when the great Chan teacher Hongzhi created a collection of 100 koans that he had pulled from other collections. Back then, there was a large literature of collections of stories about an individual Zen teacher, and then collections of stories about groups of Zen teachers. And the three big koan collections, the Blue Cliff Record, the Book of Serenity, and the Gateless Gate, all then went out and collected stories from those other collections, assembled them, and then the compiler would write sometimes a commentary, always a poem that was supposed to illustrate the point of this koan. So Hongzhi created his collection of these of 100 koans, and he wrote a verse. The collection he wrote was then elaborated upon by Wansong, another Zen master, who took the story and the poem, wrote an introduction to each of the stories, and a commentary on the story and a commentary on the verse. And that is the collection then that we have in the Book of Serenity. The version we have is still sort of abbreviated because there were other teachers over time who would write comments. And it was sort of interesting. They would write their comments as margin notes. So along different points that the different Zen teachers who compiled the collection made, they would have their own, sometimes write their approval or make the point in a different way, or they would talk about how completely wrong this point was. It's sort of an interesting dialogue, and that's really part of the point of studying the koans. I mean, when you study the koans formally, which we do differently from people who practice Rinzai koan study, you certainly read the story, the commentary, the poem. You focus more on individual phrases and see what resonates with you. But the point then is not that these are not riddles in which you're coming up with some special answer. There's koans tend to focus on, let's say, clarifying issues, especially issues about different dichotomies of who we are as individual people and as aspects or facets of this large world, so that we are really not individuals, but we are can only be appreciated and understood and act as in relation to this entire world and in this dynamic causal interrelationship that we have with everything. But there are always other, these stories are full of dichotomies of north and south and meditation and wisdom and many things and unity. Who are we? They're sort of teasing out the different ways about how we think of ourselves and the world and how we might alternative ways of doing that and creating a flexibility of mind. I mean, we tend to think of ourselves as we will create an identity. This is who I am. This is how April is. This is how I'm supposed to act. Here's how I'm supposed to be. Here's how April is supposed to be. And then flip that into alternative perspectives of seeing that, because our issue is not so much talking about ourselves as individuals or the world as some great one, but our attaching to those and with then the emotional suffering that comes when things don't quite fit the way things are, our image of how things are supposed to be and who we are. So let's just read part of this first one. This is case 12 called Dizang Planting the Fields. And the introduction by Wansong says, and I'm going to change some of the wording a little bit. There are alternative translations of this, and I think that Thomas Cleary, who translated this, he did a fabulous job, but I think there are other people have addressed some of the things that are just clearer and more to the point. So the introduction by Wansong begins, Buddhist scholars plow with the pen. Preachers plow with the tongue. We patch-robed mendicants lazily watch a white ox on an open ground, not paying attention to the abundant rootless grass. How to pass the days? So the case then is that Dizang asked Shushan, where do you come from? And Shushan said, from the south. And Dizang said, how is Buddhism in the south these days? And Shushan said, well, there's extensive debate. And Dizang said, how can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat? And Shushan said, well, what can you do about the suffering beings in the three realms? And Dizang, what do you mean, what are you talking about the suffering beings in the three realms? And then Hongzhe wrote his verse that source and explanation variously are all made up. Passing to ear from mouth, it comes apart. Planting fields, making rice, ordinary household matters. Only those who have investigated to the full would know. Having investigated to the full, you clearly know there's nothing to seek. Zifang, after all, didn't care to be enfeoffed as a marquis. Forgetting his state, he returned, same as fish and birds, washing his feet in the Zhanglang, the hazy waters of autumn. So it's a pretty short story. It may seem a little cryptic. But anyway, maybe we can talk about some of the themes. I passed out copies so you could read it now, but also take it home and spend a little time thinking about it. So in the introduction, I mean, there are a number of things to note, and Wansong starts off introducing a theme that pervades all of Zen from its legendary beginnings with Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who is supposed to have brought Zen Buddhism to China. So Bodhidharma has a set of four slogans that are supposed to be characteristic of Zen Buddhism. One is a transmission outside of the scriptures. Don't depend on words and letters. Point directly to the mind. realize your true nature and attain Buddhahood. So, you know, that suspicion of words and letters, of speech and thought and writing, is a very common theme throughout Buddhism, with this idea that we're going to have some concept that we become affixed to. This is April. By God, it's not supposed to snow on the 14th of April. But it carries out onto who I am. You know, I'm the oldest son. I'm supposed to do this sort of thing. This isn't supposed to happen to me, and so on. I've worked here for 5 years. I am supposed to get a promotion by now, that sort of stuff. And you see these themes, a couple of themes that are kind of interesting, right? You see that dichotomy, and the dichotomy of the Buddhist scholars and the preachers who plow with their pen and plow with the tongue, but the monks aren't involved. And so you can see this sort of agricultural theme that's also in the story down in the bottom, that they're plowing with these straight lines. They're using words when they preach and when they write about Buddhist scriptures. But the monks, they don't plow. They're watching this white ox walk around aimlessly through the field in all sorts of circles. No straight lines for them. And they don't pay attention to the abundant rootless grasses. So rootless grasses is a very common metaphor in Zen for things and for thoughts, because they have no ultimate reality, or at least they have some reality, but it's not the whole story. Things aren't things. So they're thoughts that they're not plowing with thoughts. They're not plowing with speech. They're watching thoughts come and go, and when they do that, they are able to, by observing the mind, they see ultimate true nature of emptiness of the world. This white ox. The ox is frequently a metaphor. You've seen the ox story, drawings of seeking for the ox, the awakened mind for true reality. And it's a white ox because it has no marks, no distinctions. It's just white, open, ultimate reality with no things in it. So you've got that. The monks are really doing the true way. They realize true reality by not getting attached to words and letters and thoughts and letting it go. But I think that the thing that's interesting is that this koan does have this agricultural theme, and I think it's important to understand, and at least as you read this, just sort of question the first reading we have, this first understanding. Oh, the monks of the true way, because they have nothing to do with words and letters, but these scholars and preachers are really misguided because they're wasting everybody's time plowing with words. But it's important to realize that Buddhist practice in Chinese is often referred to as cultivation. And a cultivation that leads to a spiritual sustenance. So when we have this dichotomy between the scholars and preachers who plow with words and supposed to the monks who don't pay a lot of attention to words, they observe the mind and really see ultimate reality, you have to take that. You have to be at least aware that there's at least a suggestion that the scholars and preachers are also involved in practice that leads to spiritual sustenance. It's in the background at the very least. So Hongzhi's story is about two teachers, Dizang and Shushan. And in the commentary that follows the story, you can read another story about an interaction that they had previously. Where Shushan really did not understand a point that that Dizang was trying to make. I mean, Shushan came with a number of teachers and were visiting Dizang's monastery and ignoring him because I guess they thought he didn't have anything to add to the conversation, and he Dizan came and I said, well, do you mind if I ask you a question? And they said, yeah, okay, what? And he says, well, these mountains and rivers, are they the same or different? And Shushan said, oh, they're completely different. And Dizan held up two fingers without saying anything. So you've got these two things, but they're joined at the root, right? And so Shushan goes, oh, no, they're the same. And Dizan held up two fingers and walked off. And one of the other monks said, well, why do you think he did that? And Shushan said, oh, he's just being arbitrary. And the other monk said, well, I don't know that that's really true. And Shushan sort of closed out that discussion by saying, well, are there any elephant tusks in a rat's mouth? So, you know, Dizan is not the dignified Dharma elephant who knows great things. He's just a rat. He has nothing. So now we're having this next meeting between Shushan and Dizan. So Dizan asked Shushan, where do you come from? And this is kind of a, you know, he's starting one of these traditional Zen dialogues, Dharma combat. This where do you come from is a question that comes up in koan after koan after koan, saying, okay, who are you? Where do you come from? Explain yourself. And there are all sorts of different ways people have responded. Some koans, they'll provide an answer that the teacher will say, yep, that's good, or he'll correct it. Sometimes it's not verbal at all. Someone will stand up with a hoe and slam it on the ground. So the whole idea is, I'm not going to get involved in words and letters. I'm just going to manifest myself as just this moment, me in this world right here. That's who I am. And that sort of answer usually gets accepted, at least until the next question comes. So Shushan says, from the south. So he doesn't pick up on that at all. I mean, it's not inaccurate. It's not wrong to say he's from the south, but he's not getting involved in coming back with some sort of very Zen-y response, right? So not going to try to make things interesting. And Dizan says, he takes another run at it. He says, well, how's the Buddha Dharma in the south these days? And Shushan could say, right? He could come back and try and take this big perspective, sort of overall view, and say, what are you talking about? The Dharma is the same everywhere. And that's an answer that's got a lot of history in Zen as well, because the legendary sixth patriarch of Zen, Wenang, was an illiterate laborer from the south who came up north to practice Zen and work in a monastery, and he wanted to study Zen. And the fifth patriarch said, well, you're just a barbarian from the south. Well, there's no point. And Wenang said, well, there's no north or south in Buddha nature. And that was enough to say, okay, yeah, you can stay at the monastery and study here. But at any rate, so Shushan doesn't say that. He says, well, there's extensive debate. And Dizan says, well, how can that compare to what we do up here? Just planting the fields and making rice to eat. So, right, he's gonna say, well, we don't up here, you know, we don't get caught up in words and letters like you ignorant barbarians down in the south. We manifest Buddha nature directly through wholehearted involvement with the activity of this moment. Right? And so that might be kind of a good, that might be a good thing to do. That would be a way of plowing and making rice and eating rice, all those things, not getting caught up in words and letters, would be a very, very good thing to do. It would be a way of expressing your Buddha nature. But you have to question, right, the response. It's just, is that what he's doing? He's coming in, well, you ignorant fools in the south may get involved in your debates about Buddhism, but we don't up here. We've transcended all that because we plow the fields and we harvest the rice and we eat rice. Shushan, it's Shushan's turn to talk, and what he could have said was, well, and Wansong also says this, is he could have said, well, yeah, it's not just in the South that we have a lot of Dharma debates, I guess. That's right. I mean, here's Dizang saying, well, we don't do this Dharma debate thing up here in the North. He's going, wait, you started this conversation, and you're the one who's kind of probing, and now you're saying, oh, no, you're wrong. Your practice is misguided. There's no need for Dharma debate. You go, well, what are you doing then? But that's not what Shushan decides to do. He says, well, what can you do about the suffering beings in the three worlds? You have this self-absorbed practice in your monastery, planting the rice and eating your rice. How are you going to take care of the suffering of other beings in the three worlds? And Dizang then replies, well, what do you call the suffering? What are you talking about with the suffering beings in the three worlds? And you can see that as one more shot at Dizang sort of saying, well, I'm taking this ultimate wide approach where there are no individual suffering beings and there are no three worlds. I think it is true that he's saying that there are no three worlds. We're in the three worlds. We're here. We're practicing Buddhism. We're trying to deal with the suffering of beings in the three worlds. There are no three worlds. It's just a world. There's just suffering beings, and we're suffering beings. But, right, he seemed, again, sort of not just expressing the view, expressing reality. It's more argumentative. He's taken a position, and he's, by gosh, he's going to defend that position. So, time if we can. Where am I? Okay. Got to keep moving. So, what I would urge you to do is read the poem by Hongzhi and the commentary by Wansong, where they sort of come out in a way that Zen ordinarily doesn't, to try to make things very clear about this discussion, in saying that, you know, you can have two ways of approaching the world within Zen Buddhism. You can commune with the source, which is transcending thought, transcending words and letters in order to interact with your life. Or you can commune by speech, which is attempting to avoid words and letters and thoughts and speech that are confusing, deluded, that stick to fixed things, what I think Dogen would refer to as measuring mind, the measuring mind we're supposed to drop off, the measuring mind that says, this is how things are. There are a bunch of different things. There are different kinds of Buddhism. There's communing by speech, and there's communing with the source, and as if those are different things, and then and working from that, measuring mind. So this is what this is what that is, this is how this is supposed to be, that's how that's supposed to be, this is better than that, this is greater, this is lesser, this is right, the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it. You have to drop those off. And both Hongzhi and Wansong would say that this world, seeing the world as source and seeing the world through speech, is an arbitrary construct. There's just the world, seeing the world, you know, coming to the world, communing with the source, communing through speech, are perspectives, but that's all they are. There's no separate world. There is just this. That's that's where we have to be. We can't get stuck in even an idea that there's some absolute source, that there's something called emptiness, or something called Buddha nature, and something called form or things or me or self. In order to come back to drop off that clinging to thoughts and attitudes and those assumptions about how things are and how things are supposed to be. And then we can step outside of the suffering, the confusion and the suffering that comes with that at the same time. So I'm going to leave that for here and see if anyone else has thoughts about the story or any ways in which this problem might show up in your own life, like thinking that it's not supposed to snow on April 14th. My life's a little more troubled than yours is. I'm not hearing anything. Yes, Kathy? I don't think it's saying that the forms are...
Not the forms per se, but just the constructs.
Or the constructs. I think the story would suggest that thinking about things is also a way of communing with what's real and expressing what's real. So long as someone says, who are you? I'm Douglas Floyd. I work as a lawyer at the American Medical Association. There's more to the story, and that you don't get locked into that and what my expectations are for my life as Douglas Floyd, rather than as part of this entire world that's engaged in the world. So, I think that this story is frequently read as, boy, Dizong really showed Shushen. Because Shushen's very tied up in this Dharma combat kind of stuff, and Shushen clarified for him that that's not the way to go. I think this is a story that's, I think, a little more layered than that, and I'm sure there are many, many other layers. There are certainly other readings. I won't say that's the only reading, but I think it lends itself to that sort of reading. And the idea that there's not some enlightened master dealing with some deluded student, but people who have devoted their lives to the study of the Dharma and have some significant devotion to the Dharma and understanding of the Dharma, but who still do the same thing we do and get caught on these positions and these views of the world and themselves. And so I think that's the real message. The real message here is not about words, you know, which is better, words or letters, but the fact that we get caught. It's the message of this is watch out. Yes, Nation.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. I was kind of just relating to the, you know, getting caught in words and letters thing, and thinking about how I really like to use Google searches to figure out, you know, all I can know about something, or, you know, all I can briefly know about something without delving into specialized study of it. And I, you know, they're very helpful with, like, you know, how to change a flat tire, you can watch a video on it, you can, Google how do I do any number of things. But I also like to use it for things that can't ever be answered, like, should I quit my job? How long am I going to live? But, you know, it's like sometimes things are really troubling me. I just can't let it go, and I just like to, you know, let's just do a Google search and see what we get.
You need a magic eight ball, clearly.
And I think that's maybe a little bit what this koan is talking about, that there are things that we can do with communication and with our actions in the world, and there are things that, need to be done. We need to eat, we need to plow the fields, we need to, you know, tell people how to escape from a burning building if that's what they need to do. But there are things that we can't use speech and language and discussion for, like, sorting out how do I deal with this complex situation of maybe, you know, my loved ones growing old and infirm and not knowing, you know, when to step in and when to, you know, step back, and or how do I deal with all the anxiety that comes up around some of these questions. We can do a Google search on those things, and we can use words and letters, but we also really need to sit with ourselves and sit and find the answer within ourselves. And so I think that's a you know, sort of a turning point in this for me, with all of those things. What do you do about the world? You can't always quantify in words and letters what the world is.
Yeah.
You know, what's our internal world? How do I know that, you know, when I look at that cushion and I say black, that I'm seeing the same black that you're seeing? I've always wondered about this. So there's so much, you know, there's so much there that we constantly have to ask ourselves, you know, am I really paying attention to what's there, or am I just what can be said about what's there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it's you know, one of the things about this story and about the Book of Serenity that makes it a very distinctive sort of Soto collection is that it doesn't say give up words and letters. It really does say, okay, you have to say something. There is value in speech and utility in speech, even speech that can lead to better understanding and awakening. And both of these participants in the talk have say legitimate things or talk about legitimate things. I mean, there's lots of Dharma debate in the South. Modern Zen came from that. That's what these koan collections are. These are dialogues that are supposed to help us understand how to live. And on the other hand, you know, Dizong is right that we can't get hung up on thinking about these things or get caught up in the words and letters. We have to wake up to the reality of what we're doing right now and engage wholeheartedly. And I think that what's really interesting about this is while they both have points and their perspective, legitimate perspectives that they're saying, this becomes not a discussion, this becomes hardened positions and an argument. And I think it's edifying in that sense of how we have to avoid grabbing on to a view and thinking that's the truth, that's the true view, I can rely on that, this is it. So, yes, Brian.
Yeah, it seems as though quite often in some of the literature that I've seen and in our conversations here, this business of valuing, as you just said, the words and letters, but also the don't get caught up in that, and the planting the fields and lazily watching the white ox on the open field. There always seems to be in Zen a bias towards, well, words and letters are fine, but don't get caught up in that because there's just being. Does it work the other way too in Zen, where it's like, well, just being is fine, but don't get caught up in that. There are words and letters, and maybe you should do some study.
Yes, absolutely.
Because if you can get all kind of dreamy about oneness and just sort of wandering around, watching the White Ox and not having any engagement intellectually or any other way with the material.
Yeah, definitely that's the case. And in these monasteries, the monks did study as well. You know, they'd have 3 months at a time sitting zazen 12 hours a day and doing some ceremonies, but they weren't allowed to read anything. But on the other two periods of 3 months of the year, there would be sutra masters who would travel from monastery to monastery and give lectures and hold seminars about the scriptures. So and they were reading intensely. And so, you know, if you read the koans, all these people are quoting the scriptures constantly. And for that matter, Wansong, when he does his commentary and he starts talking about this communing with the source and communing by speech, is pulled from the Lankavatara Sutra. Those are phrases that are from the Lankavatara Sutra, and he has a quotation from the Lankavatara Sutra. So they were familiar with
that. Some teachers at that time who were cautioning against just sitting, who were sort of criticizing the just sitting school as being lazy or not intellectually engaged. Or am I misreading that?
I think that the critiques tended to be, between people like, you know, Hongzhou taught a kind of meditation that he would refer to as silent illumination, which is sort of the predecessor of Shikan Taza, as our founder Dogen in the 13th century talked about it. And at the same time, his good friend Dawei was teaching koan practice and contemplating koans in your sitting as a way to lead you to a breakthrough, a transformation in understanding and the way your mind dealt with the world. And Dawei would complain about people who practice silent illumination were somehow very passive and quietist and just, getting caught up in some false emptiness and blankness that didn't make any sense. But I don't think that was necessarily about just sitting and not reading scriptures. I think that was Dawei and Hongzhu were very good friends as well, and so I don't think Dawei was talking about Hongzhu necessarily. But I don't know about people who said just sit. I don't know that there was ever a time when even in Zen monasteries they would say no sutras, no reading. Yes. Yeah, and I think the ability to sort of see both. I mean, we have to, Dainin Katagiri, who founded the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, wrote more than two books, but his first two books were Return to Silence, so having to learn to commune with the source. But his next book was You Have to Say Something. And when you start to say something, you're talking about things. In using concepts, and so we have to be able to do both. We have to be able to, if nothing else, we have to be able to talk to other people about what talk to ourselves about what we're doing, so we don't get lost in the weeds. And we need to be able to talk to other people about what we're doing too, because it's valuable, and they may want to know. Yes.
So I've been told many times to just sit, but I find it's part of maybe human nature to naturally be curious about this Zen thing and to read a lot about it. And so I sort of just felt like it wasn't too much of a problem to say just sit, because I don't know, like human nature sort of like that natural curiosity towards this just said, well, we need people to actually
be. Yeah. Well, and Wansong would say, if you read the commentary, as I urge you to do, he talks about, there's an artificial distinction between the source and communing with the source in speech and communing by speech, but focusing on words and letters and speech without communing with the source and learning to sit and let go of thoughts and words and letters is like the sun being covered by clouds. The way to have the sun in a clear sky is to combine speech and the communing with the source. We have to understand what we're doing. And that requires words. Yes? Yeah, I think for just such a short story, it's really very artful in having so many different layers. But it is really artificial, right? Because this whole idea of Dizong talking about, well, we monks in the north, we do a lot of plant rice and we eat rice and that sort of thing. There, in none of those monasteries did monks actually go out and plow the fields and plant rice, right? They were trying to sit for 12 hours a day. And the way those monasteries were allowed to exist is that wealthy people and the imperial government gave them lots of money and land. The way they survived was as landowners who rented their land to farmers who gave them the rice to eat. So a lot of people worked very hard to let the monks study Zen. So this is really a literature. It's interesting that for much of the history of studying koans and all these stories, people thought, well, these are historical documents. They're not historical documents. It's literature. These are stories that were fabricated to make points. And some of them may include actual words of some of these Zen teachers, and others not. But they are literary documents that are opening doors for us, making things clear for us. Anyway, we should wrap this up then.